Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's Human Rights Campaign Telephone Town Hall. I'm Christopher Sperron, the Senior Vice President of Development and Membership at the Human Rights Campaign. I use the pronouns he, him, and his, and I'm pleased to be on the call tonight with HRC's President Alfonso David and Dr. Carl Streed. Tonight, we're going to be discussing what COVID-19 means to the LGBT community, what we as an organization are doing to support our community through these challenging times, and how we are continuing our work towards equality for all despite the uncertainty ahead. Many of you have submitted questions in advance, and we'll hopefully answer as many of those as possible. We expect this call to last just under an hour. Again, my name is Chris, and we are so thrilled to have so many of you here on HRC's Telephone Town Hall. We are actually loading people into the call right now. People are calling in from all over the country. We've received a huge response from folks who wanted to be part of the call, and we are allowing folks to sort of enter the call right now. In just a moment, I'm going to invite Alfonso David, who's HRC's president, to make some introductory remarks. I'm going to also have a couple of questions for all of you as participants as we move through the call, and you'll be able to answer those. Press 1, 2, 3, or 5 on your call to answer those polling questions. So while we pause for 1 second, we're just going to take 1 second and then turn it over to Alfonso. I want to remind everybody who are unfamiliar with Alfonso. He actually comes to us from the state of New York, where he was working for Governor Cuomo up until, I guess, about 8 months ago. So as you think about the center of the crisis and sort of what's happening, it's exciting to have someone who comes from the Cuomo administration who really knows how to get things done, and that's HRC's president, Alfonso David. He is a civil rights lawyer, the first person of color to serve as president of HRC in our nearly 40-year history. He has been leading us through a lot of uncertain times, and we're thrilled that he is at the helm of the organization right now. So why don't I turn it over to HRC's president, Alfonso David, for his thoughts and observations about what we're doing and how we're going to do it going forward.
Chris, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Hello, everyone. This is Alfonso David. My pronouns are he, him, and his. Thank you all for joining us today. Hi, and all of you on the call are doing well. I hope your families and your colleagues are doing well. This is an incredibly unsettling time, and I know that we all are walking around with a fair amount of anxiety. So thank you all for joining us. Today, we are grappling with a new reality called COVID-19, and we're grappling with what this virus means for our lives, for how we work, for how we communicate. And as we navigate an ever-changing landscape, we have and will continue to take steps to protect and inform our communities and advance our work, which I believe is more critical now than ever. Every one of us has been personally affected by this national crisis. We know people who have lost their jobs. We know people who have been affected by the virus. We know people, unfortunately, some of us know people who have died from the virus. All of us are being personally affected. And every one of us is trying to cope and embrace a new, yet undefined future. It's okay, as I said before, to be anxious. It's okay to be scared. And most importantly, it is okay for us to lean on one another, lean on the HRC family, lean on the LGBTQ community for support and community during these most extraordinary times. While these are difficult times, the Human Rights Campaign continues to march forward, just as we have in other crises in the past. First, we are working to ensure that LGBTQ people are cared for during this crisis and that they're not treated differently because they are LGBTQ. This virus is having a disproportionate negative impact on LGBTQ people. Biases and prejudices that we already face in our daily lives are now being compounded for the unemployed, for those living with HIV, for seniors, for hourly wage workers, healthcare workers, and for those living with chronic conditions. Our team is incredibly accomplished, and they're tireless. and our team is working overtime from their houses to ensure that the obstacles that are facing LGBTQ people in this crisis are not forgotten and they're not ignored. The Human Rights Campaign and especially our foundation programs have pivoted to make sure that we're providing key programs and key resources to help the community during this crisis. COVID-19 is our landing page on the HRC website, www.hrc.org, where we provide key resources. The HRC Foundation also released a research brief outlining health and economic risks that are faced by the LGBTQ community during the COVID-19 crisis. We also signed an open letter to the media and health officials, joining more than 100 community-based organizations, highlighting our community's increased vulnerability to the coronavirus. We also signed an open letter to Congress, demanding more to protect people living with HIV from the threat of COVID-19. We held a virtual interfaith service to talk about the relationship between communities of faith and the LGBTQ community, and we will continue to do those. And with the number of primaries coming up in the 2020 election on the horizon, we joined a letter to election officials asking them to urge to take additional steps to protect the right to vote during this public health crisis. As we confront this crisis, we cannot lose sight of our long-term goals. Our focus of our remaining work remains on advancing the rights of LGBTQ people around the world and defeating Donald Trump and Mike Pence in November. We remain focused on electing a pro-equality president. We remain focused on electing a pro-equality Senate, and we remain focused on building our majority in the House of Representatives. You can go to hrc.org/election2020, and you can pledge to vote for equality this November. And if anyone thought that elections didn't matter, they can see that during this crisis, it really does, where competence actually does matter when people go into government. We are going to continue to fight against anti-equality forces as well. Even during this pandemic, last week the Idaho legislature passed HB 500, which is a bill that would bar transgender women and girls from participating in sports consistent with their gender identity. They also passed another bill, HB 509, which would forbid transgender people living in Idaho from changing their gender marker on birth certificates to match their gender identity. These bills are unconstitutional. These bills are offensive, and we are asking Governor Little in Idaho to veto these bills. We will continue to work towards our goals, and we are going to continue to weather this crisis like we've weathered crises before. For us to be successful, though, for us to be successful in this work, we continue to need commitment and support from our entire community and our allies. The Human Rights Campaign was founded in some of the most challenging times during the HIV/AIDS crisis, and we continue to persevere because our work is important. We have been through tough times before, tough times politically, tough times emotionally, tough times financially. Some of us may be too young to remember the HIV/AIDS crisis, when an HIV diagnosis was a guaranteed death sentence for many people. Some of us may have no real memory of 9/11 and its aftermath on our country. This is one of those tests. COVID-19 is challenging who we are as a community and who we are as a nation and who we are as members of a global community. We are in the driver's seat for our community, and it is on us to bring about change. It's on us to bring about change now, and it is on us to bring about change in November. I hope that tonight you will find this telecom hall really informative. I hope that you will find ways for you to engage with HRC and in the broader community of civil rights advocates and progressive advocates in our quest for full equality. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to a guest that we have joining us, Dr. Carl Freed, Jr. He is an assistant professor of medicine at Boston University School of Medicine. After attending medical school and residency in internal medicine at Johns Hopkins He completed his fellowship in general internal medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital and received his master's of public health from Harvard School of Public Health. Nationally, he has chaired the American Medical Association Advisory Committee on LGBT issues and served on the board of GLMA, Health Professionals Advancing LGBTQ Equality. Dr. Street's efforts to improve the health and well-being of the LGBTQ community have earned him several awards, notably from the University of Chicago Alumni Association, the American Medical Association Foundation, the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, as well as recognition from the Obama White House. Carl is the research lead for the Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery at Boston Medical Center, which is a leader on HRC Foundation's Healthcare Equality Index. There, he collaborates with researchers, physicians, and staff to assess and address the health and well-being of transgender and gender-diverse individuals. I'll now turn it over to Dr. Carl Street, Jr. for some opening remarks.
Thank you, Alfonso, and thank you, everybody, for having me. Dr. Carl Street, pronouns he, him, his. I've been brought on to really kind of provide some medical perspective about what's going on with the coronavirus. I apologize up front because I'm a bit of a fast talker, and I'm trying to provide a broader review of what we do understand right now. Remember, information is in flux. New information is coming out constantly, so I'm trying to hit some of the high points for everyone. We will have time for Q&A at the end as well. But I want to start off really highlighting that coronaviruses at a pandemic level or an endemic level have been around, well-characterized, at least since the 1960s. And we really are very familiar with their potential for causing severe disease in humans, with examples of SARS and MERS. So the current coronavirus is really another example of something we knew was coming down the pike. And we really have already been doing a number of model studies for the past few decades for what these kind of pandemics could look like and where our weaknesses are. So what we're facing right now is not truly a surprise among public health officials and infectious disease specialists. We had an opportunity early on to be prepared for this. So what we're facing right now is something that potentially could have been avoidable or at least lessened, as it were. But to focus more on coronavirus, the main thing, some main key points here. So we know near the end of December, China reported on a cluster of unique cases of pneumonia among a group of people who had contact with a seafood market in Wuhan. By January, the Chinese health authorities had confirmed that this cluster was in fact associated with a new coronavirus or novel coronavirus, which now has the name of essentially COVID-19 or coronavirus disease 2019. Although cases were originally thought to only be related to contact with the seafood market in Wuhan, it became quickly apparent that there was person-to-person transmission. So with regards to transmission, the main mode of transmission is through respiratory droplets, so coughing, sneezing, and so forth. But there is evidence to suggest that there may be a fecal-oral route, as well as viable virus has been found within stool. The virus also has been found to remain viable or infectious in the air for a few hours, as well as on surfaces for up to a few days. This really gets to the point of making sure that we are covering our mouths when we're coughing or sneezing, making sure we're washing our hands and washing surfaces that we have contact with. A major issue with the virus in terms of how it is spreading is that there is a significant potential for spread among people who are infected but have no symptoms. So people who really don't have a severe cough or difficulty breathing or a sore throat can, in fact, still shed the virus, leading to more infections. There have been studies showing that people have tested positive for coronavirus within their throat and their nasopharynx or high up within their nose, even when they only have just a sore throat. So this really drives home the point that we really need to be focusing on self-isolation, even if we are feeling well or really only just have a bit of a scratchy throat. What I also want to talk about here, of course, is the incubation period. So from the time somebody's been exposed and infected to when they show symptoms is quite variable. It can be as early as 2 days after being infected and as long as 2 weeks out, which is why we are recommending that self-isolation for people who've had contact with known cases of COVID-19, that they self-isolate for 14 days so that we can see that they remain asymptomatic during that time. There are a few other topics to talk about within public health, but I want to really jump more into the clinical presentation. The main issue here, of course, is that we are ramping up for seasonal allergy season. We're ending our influenza season just as this is really going around. So a lot of people having upper respiratory symptoms with sniffles and scratchy eyes and sore throats. The main stuff that we know for sure for coronavirus is, though, that it's mainly people with significant fevers. So we're talking about at least a temperature of 100.2 Fahrenheit. We're talking about cough. It's often a dry cough. And then most significantly is shortness of breath. And I'm not talking about just like a little bit like, oh, I feel like I can't catch my breath fully. It's more like you feel like you are very winded sitting still or when you're just doing routine activities. Any little change is the big issue here. Of course, these are the main symptoms that we're seeing in the majority of folks. It's not the only symptoms. There are cases of people who have only diarrhea or gastric, some sort of stomach upset. But, of course, these can all progress to more severe forms of it, where we see significant pneumonia affecting both lungs. We're seeing issues with how people are being able to breathe on their own to the point where they need to be on a respirator or a ventilator. And then, of course, we are seeing people who have significant issues with their heart, which can happen with some viral infections. And then, of course, we are seeing death. I want to point out that compared to SARS and MERS, that we're still gathering information about how fatal a coronavirus is across the globe. So by comparison, SARS in the early 2000s had a fatality rate approaching 10%, according to the World Health Organization. And then MERS in 2012 really had a more significant fatality rate of close to 35%. Right now, based on current numbers reported by Johns Hopkins, is that the global fatality rate for coronavirus is around 5%. That 5% really doesn't tell us, though, the reality that we're seeing is that people are at different ages with different health conditions are presenting with different sets of symptoms. So the people who are most at risk for severe presentations of coronavirus infection or who are at most risk for fatal outcomes from coronavirus are people over the age of 60 and individuals with any kind of chronic illness, so moderate to severe asthma, COPD, heart disease, as well as untreated HIV. I want to really highlight this, that there's been some reports saying that people with HIV in general are at risk for more severe complications. It's more to do with being untreated or having a detectable viral load or having a low CD4 count. I want to really drive home the point that HRC and other places like Fenway have really highlighted how this is disproportionately affecting LGBTQ individuals, both economically as well as with regards to their health. And I want to really drive home the point that we're really talking about maintaining physical distance to prevent the spread of this virus. Everybody's been talking about social distancing. I really want to dissuade people from using that term to make sure that people recognize that they should remain socially connected. Isolation, especially during a pandemic like this, is very harmful for our health. Our last Surgeon General really was making it his mission to really work on addressing loneliness and isolation. And as we're doing our best to self-isolate to prevent the spread of coronavirus, I want us to really maintain contact with our friends, our loved ones, our family, particularly our family of choice, and across generations as well, since we do know that elderly individuals are most at risk of being isolated and very lonely during this time. I want to talk more specifically about trans and gender-affirming care. So gender-affirming medical and surgical care, we all agree, is essential to long-term well-being of our transgender and gender-diverse patients, families, and communities. But we also are talking about their short-term health care is paramount. So as we are dealing with coronavirus, gender-affirming procedures at our facilities and pretty much all other healthcare facilities by request of the Surgeon General have been postponed to safeguard the health of our patients. Our Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery is still fielding phone calls, still conducting telemedicine visits and managing hormone therapy. We do not know of any shortages in hormone therapy or medications at this time, so we really encourage people to not necessarily stockpile, but to make sure they have a 3-month supply of their medication. We want to really dissuade people from hoarding any kind of supplies because that alone could actually really affect the supply chain. And I do want to talk about access to sexual and reproductive health care options, particularly abortion. healthcare centers are still providing abortions and other contraceptive needs and sexual health and reproductive health care needs based on their urgency and timing. So any facility or any state that is taking advantage of this and shutting down all abortions is doing it from a strictly political motivation, not from a healthcare or evidence-based perspective. So I want to remind people that we are doing the best we can with the information we have, and that some decisions, unfortunately, are being made with political motivation in mind. So be sure to lobby your representatives as well as your state leaders to really be focused on the evidence and not the politics behind a lot of this. I definitely have many more things I could say, but I want to highlight again that the important thing here is to practice physical distancing, remaining socially connected, and really being sure to wash your hands and washing surfaces. And if you can, donate any kind of supplies to your healthcare centers, and also be sure to support your local businesses, particularly service industry. So thank you. I want to pass it back.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Streed. We really appreciate that really comprehensive perspective on this, and I know our members have a lot of great questions that we are going to move to now, and we'll have Alfonso David, HRC President, and Dr. Streed available to answer those questions. Before we do that, though, we want to get going with a quick polling question for everyone on the phone. This just helps us understand a little bit more about your involvement with HRC. So we'd love you to use your keypad, and we'd like to get a sense of how long you've been involved with HRC as a member or supporter or just been involved in our work. So press 1 if it's less than 1 year. Press 2 if it's 1 to 5 years. Press 3 if it's 6 to 10 years. And press 4 if it's been 10 or more years. Once again, 1 for less than a year, 2 for 1 to 5 years, 3 if it's 6 to 10 years, and 4 if it's more than 10 years. This data will help us figure out how to make sure we're reaching out to people from all backgrounds and involvement with the organization, so we really appreciate your help on that poll question. Now we're going to turn it over to me to ask our moderator, our participants, some key questions. And I just wanted to share some broad overviews. We've actually received about 80 questions about COVID, about 35 or so questions about helping others, many around HIV, and a lot of those questions have been covered already. But let me dive into some of the ones that rise to the top. How can LGBTQ members who can't donate blood because of the current legislation contribute to the fight against COVID-19? And that's from Evangelos, who's in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
So that's an excellent question. So I definitely have many thoughts, both personal as well as medically informed about.
You're welcome to editorialize.
I don't want to editorialize. So I would focus here more about actually reaching out to your local healthcare facilities and asking how can you volunteer if there's opportunities to volunteer. I would also look to other resources that you might be able to donate, again, if you can finance, if you can provide a financial donation. And I want to point out that healthcare centers are using these donations not necessarily just for wages for their healthcare workers, but are actually using them for services for patients. So actually buying phones and iPads for patients so that they can actually remain in contact with their family because there are no visitors allowed in the hospital right now. Also providing hotel stays for physicians so that they can self-isolate after being at work so that they cannot risk exposing their family to coronavirus. These are some of the ways that financial donations are being used.
That's great. That's great to know.
And this is Alfonso. With respect to the ban on men having sex with men, which is what it's been, and the ban to allow men having sex with men to donate blood, we have opposed that policy. I think many other organizations are opposing that policy. And we believe that with a new administration, we will have a more science-based policy that does not discriminate based on sexual orientation or gender identity.
Great. Dr. Streed, I think you answered this, but actually Sharon from Seattle, I think, asked it in a really succinct way. She wants to know, you know, in terms of vulnerabilities, is the LGBTQ community more at risk than the overall population?
So from what we understand based on population studies, that we do see more cases of asthma and COPD among LGBTQ populations. We believe that a lot of that is tied to our higher use of tobacco. So that those health conditions do put people at a higher risk of more severe presentations of coronavirus. I think we've HRC and others have really highlighted the economic effects of this, since more LGBTQ individuals are in the service industry and are dependent upon wage work. So we are expected to see a significant disparity in terms of how coronavirus is affecting LGBTQ populations. So, yes.
And this is Alfonso.
I was just going to say you should share some information on the paper that we just released.
Yeah, so the Human Rights Campaign issued a research brief last week, highlighting the unique vulnerabilities that LGBTQ people face during the coronavirus crisis. Essentially, LGBTQ people are more vulnerable to the health risk of the virus. As an example, 17% of LGBTQ people lack access to health care. 1 in 5 LGBTQ people have not seen a doctor because they cannot afford to go to a doctor. When we look at kidney disease as an example, the general population suffers from kidney disease at the rate of 3%. The LGBTQ community suffers kidney disease at a rate of 7%. But as the doctor mentioned, it's not only as it relates to health risks. We also have significant economic challenges. 1 in 5 LGBTQ people live in poverty. 40% of the youth who are homeless identify as LGBTQ. 40% of LGBTQ people work in industries that are affected by the virus, disproportionately affected. So in the restaurant and food services industry, as an example, we're talking about more than 2 million LGBTQ people affected. In the education sector, more than 2 million LGBTQ people affected. So we issued this research brief to once again highlight the disparities that LGBTQ people face, but also to make sure that policymakers understand why, when they advance policies, they have to make sure those policies are being driven by facts and data. And we're hopeful that they're going to do that. This research brief is available on our website, which is hrc.org.
Great. Thank you. Alfonso, I know you touched on this during your introduction, but this legislative session across the country, as state legislatures have been meeting, you know, I know you mentioned that we had been tracking about 700 bills that impact the LGBTQ community, and many of the state legislatures are adjourning early or, you know, changing their strategies, but we obviously were very concerned about significant amounts of legislation. We actually just received a question from somebody who wants to know, with this pandemic going on, will it buy us more time to fight this horrible legislation in Idaho? And I think it would be great for you to just highlight for our members a little bit about what that legislation looks like.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Unfortunately, we have legislatures all over the country that are focusing on bias and bigotry and discrimination, as opposed to public health. An example is Idaho. Idaho advanced legislation a few weeks ago that was just passed by both houses that would discriminate against transgender people, simply refusing to allow transgender girls from participating in sports consistent with their gender identity, and specifically requiring that if someone is transgender, or anyone, I should suspect, in participating in a certain sport, they have to prove their gender identity based on a blood test or based on DNA testing. Now, this is the same legislature that has not addressed COVID-19. Instead, they decided to focus on bigotry and bias and discrimination. And we have to do everything in our power to make sure that we mobilize this November, not only at the federal level. This election is not only about the President of the United States. A lot of it is, but we are also focused on Congress, and we're focused on state and local races, because you have elected officials who are not representing the interests of their constituents. They are advancing an anti-equality narrative that is not necessary. It is not useful. In fact, it is offensive. They are looking to create a solution for a problem that does not exist. Transgender people have been participating in sports consistent with their gender identity for decades. They are now advancing legislation claiming that they need to make sure they protect non-LGBTQ people. I'm not sure what we're protecting them from. So what we're going to do is make sure we push back at all legislative efforts that are looking to demonize us, that are looking to remove protections that exist, and are looking to treat us as second-class citizens. The governor of Idaho has until next week, specifically the 31st of March, to act on these pieces of legislation that are pending on his desk. We have said that the governor should veto these bills, and if he refuses to veto these bills, we will take additional steps and work with our partners to challenge these bills in court.
Great. Thank you, Alfonso. And I want to also point out to our members and supporters that we've been very much engaged in grassroots activism to get people to contact the governor from within the state. And we've generated close to 300 personal phone calls to the governor asking for him to veto. But we're doing everything we can to activate. And I think everyone needs to be paying attention at this time about the vulnerabilities, because during difficult times like this, many state legislatures or people will try to get away with things that are unhealthy or dangerous to our community. I have a health-related question that I think is a really interesting one. Dr. Street, do you believe that COVID-19 will become a recurring disease like the flu? And that's from Joel in Williamsburg.
So that's a great question, and that's one a lot of us have been pondering. So Dr. Anthony Fauci, who has been one of the few voices I would trust currently from behind the press podium, has really talked about the notion of seasonality, which we see with a lot of viruses, that sometimes we see peaks like the influenza season, and then it goes away during the summer. He has postulated, and a lot of epidemiologists agree, that we probably will see this essentially enter, quote-unquote, circulation, where we'll be traveling around the globe, and will ideally, often viruses that do that, become less severe over time. So right now, I would anticipate that COVID-19 is not necessarily going to be going away anytime soon, but our public health response will be able to handle it better in the future. So yes, I would say expect this to be part of our regular seasonal viral infection.
Okay. We've actually received a lot of questions on this next topic, and I actually think both of you will have a unique perspective to offer on this one. But to summarize, I think this one encapsulates most of it. But what are the best ways to help maintain a healthy mental state during this time, especially for those who tend towards unhealthy socially isolating already? And we received several different questions about this, about trans people who are having to live in their homes, of origin, even though they may not feel welcome. We've received questions about elderly who are struggling with their own mental health and sort of how to look after their others. So I think we've probably received about a dozen questions about mental health during this time of social isolation. And I know, Dr. Street, you have some perspective, but I know Alfonso does as well. So it feels really worth getting into that.
So I'll jump in. But I mean, there's a lot of different ways in terms of maintaining your mental health. And naturally, a lot of people will definitely talk about mindfulness techniques, talking about yoga, maintaining some sort of physical activity, even if it's indoors. I myself have had to move my bike to a stand and have been working out in my living room. But the main thing I would say here is really thinking of creative ways to remain connected to other people, finding ways to interact. I have found people who are moderately tech savvy have been using a lot of different group me's, a lot of different ways to actually maintain video conferencing opportunities, or even just texting. My parents were not necessarily tech savvy, and my grandparents and other people's next generations that they maintain contact with, please just use the phone, pick it up, call somebody, reach out to whoever you need to make sure they're okay, but also recognize that this is an opportunity for you to check in on yourself. So everybody would be happy to hear from you. There are a number of services that are definitely have ramped up. Naturally, the Trevor Project, of course, is very much available. But I would leave it to Alfonso to talk about a few other organizations that are really working towards this. But I think the main thing to really think about is creative ways of remaining connected, maintaining physical distance. I would argue, unless things change, which they always can, doesn't mean you have to stay indoors all the time. I have seen many people doing great jobs of maintaining physical distance from their elders, but at least communicating through windows and things like that. So be creative while remaining connected.
Alfonso.
So I would agree with everything the doctor just said, and I'll just supplement and to say that try to make it fun as much as you can. I am staying in my apartment, and I've been in my apartment for several days, and sometimes I feel as if it's Groundhog Day, and Bill Murray is standing outside of my window, because I'm waking up every day, and it appears that we're doing the same things every day. So to the extent you can find some variety in your day and do things differently, is always helpful. I'm finding it helpful. Also, I work out every day. It's been a challenge because the gyms are closed. So I've had to think about how I can work out in the basement of my building and do yoga in my study or go running outside if possible when it's not too cold. And I think if you can incorporate some type of physical activity in this time, it would be helpful. And finally, I think in terms of addressing the issue of isolation, when I say make it fun, think about reaching out to people in your Rolodex or in your phone. If you want to call a few people in the A category on Monday and certain people in the B category on Tuesday, they will be so happy to hear from you. And what I've been trying to do is reach out to my friends and to my colleagues when I have time in the evening to just connect with them. I think it's always helpful to also think about creating book clubs or having virtual movie events or some people are having virtual cocktails. If you find a way to connect with your friends and your family in a virtual space, that is incredibly helpful after you've gone through a long work day staring at the screen or engaging in Zoom meetings. So I would suggest doing one of those three things or all three. With respect to resources, the doctor did mention the Trevor Project and other organizations that provide really great service. I would say you should also look to the LGBTQ centers. There are LGBTQ centers all over the United States, and you could go to lgbtqcenters.org and find out about some of the resources and services that they provide. We also, through the Health Equality Index, which is a tool that we use to evaluate whether or not professional medical services are inclusive. You can look through the Health Equality Index to see whether or not some of those services that are being provided to you are actually LGBTQ inclusive.
Great. And one other thing, I mean, I hope you'll pay attention to HRC social media feed, Facebook or Instagram, or follow your other favorite LGBTQ organizations. All of us are figuring out ways to create programming that's virtual, that really touches all aspects of our community. We will be rolling out a lot of new things, as well as some historic information and some videos that I think people will enjoy. But really finding the connection that means a lot to you is important, and obviously just a great reminder it's okay to ask for help from people. And we've been hearing that through a lot of the kinds of questions we're getting from folks.
Quickly about that. We're providing a lot of different ways for people to remain connected and keep their mood up. I do want to acknowledge we are facing a very unique challenge and it's very stressful. If you need to have a cry, have a cry. If you're feeling anxious, acknowledge that you're feeling anxious. Just remember to reach out to somebody to talk about it as well. Your health professionals and many of us are prepared for that. So know that your feelings are completely natural and understandable. So don't try and squash that.
Indeed. This is such a bewildering time for all of us. Speaking of bewildering, there's a question about, the Supreme Court and the election 2020. So, first question is, despite the country's, largely coming to a halt at this moment, are we still expecting the Supreme Court to rule on the Title VII cases that are coming up? And Alfonso, you may want to just highlight a little bit about what those cases are, and then share your perspective.
Sure. So for folks on the phone, there are three cases pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. The fundamental question that the court is reviewing is whether LGBTQ people are protected under current federal civil rights laws. The question that has been presented is, do LGBTQ people, are they protected from employment discrimination depending on what industry they work in? And some anti-equality advocates are suggesting that LGBTQ people are not protected, despite the fact that courts have concluded for more than two decades that LGBTQ people are, in fact, protected under federal civil rights laws. So the court is now asked to review that question, and the oral arguments have concluded. Based on the traditional schedule of the Supreme Court, we expect rulings from the court in June. We have not received any information to suggest that the court is not going to be issuing rulings in those cases. They've all been consolidated, but we don't think the court, we have no information to suggest that there is not going to be a ruling. Government is still functioning, albeit in some cases remotely, and we anticipate that the court is going to be issuing a ruling by or before June.
All right. There's actually an interesting question. How are HRC and other progressive groups planning for post-COVID-19 recovery and our quote-unquote new normal life? And I know, Alfonso, you're in touch with a lot of other progressive leaders and civil rights organization leaders. It'd be great for you to expound on what you are seeing or hearing or kind of what you think is possible.
Sure. So I'll mention a few things with respect to post-COVID-19. The doctor did say that we will probably be living with this virus, or it may not be a pandemic, but we'll certainly be living with the conditions associated with the virus for quite some time. What we're looking at also is what is coming up in November. An election is coming up in November, one of the most important, if not most important, election of our lifetimes. And we need to make sure that we have an infrastructure in place to allow people to exercise their constitutional right to vote. In the event people are still fearful of exercising their right to vote or fearful of leaving their homes, we hope that's not the case in November. But in the event that that is the case, we want to make sure we're prepared. So we have joined with other civil rights organizations and other progressive groups in making sure that states are prepared for an election that may be unlike any election in the past. We're also supporting efforts to make sure that there's absentee balloting, that there's mail-in voting. There are complications with those, of course, if people are not adequately informed about how they can engage in those processes. But we want to make sure that all tools are available to people so that they can exercise their constitutional right to vote. Second, as I mentioned before, what we're seeing is with this virus, it is exacerbating a chronic problem that we've had in many parts of our community. 1 in 5 LGBTQ people live in poverty. 1 in 5 LGBTQ people can't afford to go to the doctor. 17% of LGBTQ people don't have access to health care. So what we're doing is fighting to make sure that we can advance legislation to address some of the long-term systemic problems that we've had for decades. And with a new president, we believe that we will have an opportunity to actually transform the landscape, because people are living in pain, people are living on the streets, and they shouldn't be. And we need to fight as much as we can to really change that paradigm. And then finally, we are working with all of our coalition partners to really rethink how we can do our work. We are doing our work virtually. We anticipate that we may be doing our work virtually for quite some time. And we want to think about new and creative ways where we can provide resources, information, services to members of the LGBTQ community where we may not be able to get to them. We may not be able to physically get to them, so we need to be able to communicate with them virtually.
That's great. Alfonso, while you mentioned the election, I think it'd be really great for you to highlight for everyone on the call today a little bit about the exit polling from the primaries. I think there's some really interesting data there about the LGBTQ community that our members and supporters might not know about, but I think really shows the impact we can have and why we need to continue to persevere?
Sure. So during the primary season, we have been tracking the LGBTQ vote and specifically looking to see how members of the LGBTQ community are engaging in the electoral process. And what we found is that LGBTQ voters are punching way above our weight. I'll give you a few examples. In Arizona, as an example, LGBTQ people make up 4.5% of the adult population, but they accounted for 10% of the primary voters. Massachusetts, LGBTQ people make up 5.4% of the population, but they actually accounted for 13% of primary voters. You take a state like Alabama, 3% of LGBTQ people make up the adult population, but they made up 7% of the primary voters. Texas, 4% of LGBTQ people make up the adult population, but in the primaries, they accounted for 10% of primary voters. So we're seeing a trend all over the country where LGBTQ people are engaged in the electoral process. They're voting. They understand the importance of this election. And we hope and suspect that as we go through the rest of the primary season into the general election, we will see LGBTQ people really participating and making sure that we have someone in the White House that will represent our interests, and we also have other elected officials at state and local levels who will represent the interests of all constituents.
Alfonso, I'm really impressed that you were able to rattle off those statistics. You obviously had no idea I was going to ask that question, and I'm very impressed that you have it all right at your fingertips as we are all spread out all over the country on this call today. So thank you for that. Dr. Streed, there are actually several questions from about trans issues and trans health. And I know you as an expert in the field will have some perspective. I know you've covered some of this already, but let me just give you like a smattering of them so you can kind of summarize a little bit for the listeners. One is, how can we help trans women of color who are HIV positive? As you know, the virus can kill you if you've compromised the immune system. What are we doing for trans kids? And Alfonso, you may be able to answer this one, to be able to stay healthy and safe in their homes during this time. And are there ways that we can support or volunteer locally to assist trans individuals who may not be able to receive appropriate doctor's care and medication during this pandemic?
So excellent questions, and honestly, I feel like some of my responses are going to be universal in terms of these are things we should be doing if there wasn't a pandemic going on. So first and foremost, so anybody who's at potential risk for severe infection, as I mentioned, people who have untreated HIV are in that category. This is still all about physical distancing, washing your hands, covering your mouth when you're coughing, things like that. So that's the exact same stuff we do for individuals with untreated HIV. In terms of getting access, though, they should be connected to providers who are providing HIV care. There is no reason that that telemedicine can't actually manage this. And if pharmacies remain open, healthcare centers remain open to actually provide care. So it's a matter of connecting people to appropriate providers. The Health Equality Index really highlights which centers are going to do well by this. GLAMA, GLMA.org has a provider directory about which providers are going to do well by this. So connecting people to appropriate healthcare at this time is the same as what we need to be doing all the time. So finding who's competent and compassionate and ensure that they actually have the additional resources. Other opportunities, of course, are still donating to organizations that are providing direct services. So that includes all of our LGBTQ health centers, which have a number of programs that provide prescription assistance. So that's really important. And then there was another question, a question with regards to our trans and gender diverse youth. So this was mentioned before, and this idea of being stuck isolating, self-isolating in home environments that potentially are not supportive. And we know that family support is a critical part of ensuring the health and well-being of trans and gender diverse youth, and that any rejection or even ambivalence has been linked to poor outcomes. Again, this is about remaining connected, connecting people to appropriate resources that are providing them that support. And this also gets to being creative. These youth still have education requirements, and I would actually put this on some of our education colleagues to do their best to provide some sort of distance learning that is also gender affirming. So really highlighting learning objectives that could highlight the strength and the importance of trans and gender diverse individuals across a number of subjects in terms of either literature or history and so forth. So it really gets, again, to the need for affirmation in these connections as well. As I mentioned before, though, if you already have a healthcare provider, you still have access to healthcare that way. So I'm still prescribing, I'm still doing new patient evaluations and answering questions, and a lot of other healthcare professionals are doing the same. We've done our best to try and rapidly adapt to telemedicine. That's definitely not ideal, but I'm hoping that a lot of these adaptations persist after the pandemic.
Great. Thank you. So I have one more poll question for all of our listeners, which I think will give us a chance to get a sense of where you all are. No, and I have one or two more questions, and then we'll wrap up. And we've had such great participation with so many amazing questions. So this is a poll question for everybody on the line. I think it's going to be hard to pick one of these four topics, but I'm going to give you all a choice. All of us are feeling obviously worried and anxious about this public health crisis. What is giving you the greatest worry right now, or better yet, all that apply? So we'd ask for you to press 1 for your health, 2 for your health, the health of loved ones, 3 for finances or employment, or 4 a lack of clear leadership at the national level. So once again, press 1 for your health, 2 for the health of your loved ones, 3 for your finances or employment, and 4 for a lack of clear leadership at the national level. We have one question from a member from San Diego, and as a senior vice president for development and membership in charge of all of the fundraising for HRC, I wanted to ask this one question and make a plug. He asks, beyond donations, what are the ways you can support local LGBTQ community during the pandemic? And just as a reminder for all of you, HRC is a membership-based organization, and your continued support of our work will help ensure that we can continue to lobby on Capitol Hill, work politically to do the work that we're doing, fight for our community, provide tremendous resources with our foundation, provide opportunities like this and others. So I hope you will stick with us as well as support local organizations around the country. And Alfonso, I don't know if you had any other sort of thoughts on the other LGBTQ groups or things we can do, and you've mentioned the community centers, which I think is great, or anything more you want to add on that?
I think one of the most important things that we can do is make sure that we're reaching out to members in our community. I can't tell you how important it is, and I'm sure the doctor will amplify this, that our seniors, folks that are living with chronic conditions, need us to make sure that we're engaged with them. We know that LGBTQ people more often than not have challenges in maintaining extended family relationships. That's unfortunately been a challenge because we've been dealing with bias and discrimination as a result of coming out. And so when we're dealing with a crisis, people who are elderly, people who are living with chronic illnesses, to the extent we're able to provide some type of support and reach out to them through a variety of different networks that exist, including the LGBTQ centers, I think that is critically important. Second, I would say going to hrc.org, you will see a panoply of services and resources that are available to you. You could decide to get involved in volunteering for the election. You could decide to provide some needed resources and support in some other way. There are a variety of different ways to get involved, and I would say that is also something that you could do. Everyone on this call has something meaningful to contribute. And so to the extent folks are interested in that, I would say get online, contribute through, not financially if you're not interested in doing that, but certainly with your time and your resources. You can get involved with any of our foundation programs, or you can work with the LGBTQ centers around the country.
Great. We are just getting close to the full hour mark for this call, so I want to invite Dr. Street if there's anything additionally you want to share with our members and supporters, and then we'll have Alfonso wrap up the call today. Please know we will continue to do calls like this, We love the opportunity to connect with you. Look for us to engage here through social media, through Zoom meetings, through special seminars, and we hope you'll continue to hang with us. Let me have Dr. Streed offer any closing comments, and then we'll throw it over to Alfonso again.
Thank you again. I want to just, again, stress the importance of maintaining physical distance, but really remaining closely connected to everybody around you in as many creative ways as possible, washing your hands, cover your mouth. I also want to highlight some opportunities in terms of ways you can contribute besides just financial donations, which are important. But as Alfonso already talked about, donating your time and energy to organizations like HRT or support organizations like Trans Lifeline really have the opportunity to save somebody's life during this stressful time. And then also as a researcher, I really do need to highlight research studies that are asking about the health and well-being of LGBTQ individuals, particularly as it relates to coronavirus. The PRIDE study is an example of a participant-driven study. It is the PRIDEstudy.org, and they are surveying LGBTQ individuals and how the coronavirus is affecting them. This is a critical resource for how we can better understand our communities and how we can actually better provide resources in the future.
Thank you so much. Alfonso, before I turn it over to you, I'm just going to share what the poll results were. Interestingly, 51% of those who answered the question said their concerns were to the lack of national leadership in our country, followed by 20% who were worried about the health of loved ones, followed by 17% who are worried about their finances and employment, and 12% are concerned about their own health. Very interesting. Really says a lot about all of you and just how you think about, you know, loving our country, loving other people before even getting to your own needs. I think that really is reflective of what we know to be true about HRC members. Alfonso, why don't you wrap us up today?
So thank you, Chris. Thank you, Dr. Streed, for joining us today. And I want to thank all of you for joining this call. The Human Rights Campaign has existed for 40 years. And in those 40 years, the Human Rights Campaign has been challenging the status quo. It's been challenging the status quo where LGBTQ people have been left outside, left out of the conference room, discriminated against simply because of who we are. And in this crisis, we are seeing that some of those vestiges of discrimination and bias and prejudices are being amplified. They're being amplified in this crisis because we know that, again, 1 out of 5 LGBTQ people live in poverty, and we have to do something to address that plight. We are either protecting, advancing civil rights, compromising them, or acquiescing. And I'm really proud to be a part of an organization and a membership movement that is focused on advancing civil rights, not compromising them and not acquiescing. And I know at some point in our future, we will succeed and reach that place that we call equality. So I am just really grateful and thankful that all of you are joining us and participating and engaged in a way that we need to, because we have this concept of community. And this concept of community is really coming alive during this crisis. And I just once again want to thank all of you for participating, for contributing, for engaging with the Human Rights Campaign and engaging with us as we look to come up with solutions and support our community in the way that we need to. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, everybody. Look for more calls like this in the future. We really appreciate your help. Bye-bye.